distinguishes star sellers from the rest of the pack. Every employee in the company has filled out a survey about whether they're givers, takers, or matchers. And now it's time for me to see them in action. I enter an eye care office and express an interest in replacing a pair of broken sunglass frames that I purchased at Lens Crafters. I walk over to a display case, and I'm approached by my very first salesman. He shows me a snazzy pair of glasses and swiftly launches into a compelling pitch with powerful communication. The lenses are tailor-made for driving. The contours of the frames accentuate the shape of my face. The color matches my skin tone. I've never been mistaken for cool, but I briefly flirt with the fantasy that these shades could transform me into James Bond, or at least James Woods. When I express concerns about the price, the salesman confidently assures me that they're worth it. "They fit me so perfectly," he says, "that the designers must have had a winning face like mine in mind when they created these shades." I develop a sneaking suspicion that he's flattering me to make the sale. Taker? At another office, the salesperson offers to do me a favor. He'll replace my frames for free if I switch over to his office for eye exams. Matcher. And I have the survey data to back it up. Who's the more successful seller? The taker or the matcher? Neither. Both are right in the middle of the pack. At the third office in Knightsdale, North Carolina, I meet Kildare Escoto. Kildare is an imposing figure with thick eyebrows and a thin goatee. He's a serious weightlifter, and if you asked him right now, he could drop into 100 push-ups without breaking a sweat. His parents are from the Dominican Republic, and he grew up in rough-and-tumble New York City. He has the same title as the two salespeople I met at other offices, but his style couldn't be more different. We're the exact same age, but Kildare calls me Sir, and I sense that he means it. He speaks softly and asks me some basic questions before he even pulls out a single tray of sunglasses from the case. Have I ever been here before? Do I have a prescription to fill? What's my lifestyle like? Do I play sports? He listens carefully to my answers and gives me some space to contemplate. I have 20/20 vision, but Kildare is so good that I suddenly feel the urge to buy a pair of shades. I blow my cover. I tell him I'm studying the techniques of outstanding salespeople. Is he willing to discuss his approach? Kildare objects. I don't look at it as selling, he explains. I see myself as an optician. We're in the medical field first, retail second, sales maybe third. My job is to take the patient, ask the patient questions, and see what the patient needs. My mindset is not to sell. My job is to help. My main purpose is to educate and inform patients on what's important. My true concern in the long run is that the patient can see. The data reveal two striking facts about Kildare Escoto. First, in my survey, he had the single highest giver score of any employee in the company. Second, he was also the top-selling optician in the entire company, bringing in more than double the average sales revenue. It's not a coincidence. The second highest seller also more than doubled the average, and she's a giver too. Her name is Nancy Phelps, and she has the same philosophy as Kildare. I get involved with my patients, ask where they work, what their hobbies are, what they like to do on vacations. It's about the patients and their needs. It's revealing that when patients walk in the door, they ask for Nancy. I'm a real believer in giving patients their new fresh eyes that they're going to see their best in, she says. To see whether Kildare and Nancy are exceptions to the rule, Dane Barnes and I asked hundreds of opticians to complete a survey measuring whether they were takers, matchers, or givers. We also gave them an intelligence test, assessing their ability to solve complex problems. Then, we tracked their sales revenue over the course of an entire year. Even after controlling for intelligence, the givers outsold the matchers and takers. The average giver brought in over 30% more annual revenue than matchers and 68% more than takers. Even though matchers and takers together represented over 70% of the sellers, half of the top sellers were givers. If all opticians were givers, the average company's annual revenue would spike from approximately $11.5 million to more than $15.1 million. Givers are the top sellers, and a key reason is powerless communication. Asking questions is a form of powerless communication that givers adopt naturally. Questions work especially well when the audience is already skeptical of your influence, such as when you lack credibility or status, or when you're in a highly competitive negotiation situation. Neil Rackham spent 9 years studying expert and average negotiators. He identified expert negotiators as those who were rated as highly effective by both sides and had a strong track record of success with few failures. He recorded more than 100 negotiations and combed through them to see how the experts differed from the average negotiators. The expert negotiators spent much more time trying to understand the other side's perspective. Questions made up over 21% of the experts' comments, but less than 10% of the average negotiators' comments. If Kildare were a taker, he'd be more interested in leading with his own answers than asking questions. But instead of telling patients what they want, he asks them what they want. One day, Mrs. Jones comes out of an eye exam, and Kildare approaches her to find out if she's interested in a new pair of glasses. In one eye, she's nearsighted. In the other eye, she's farsighted. Her doctor has prescribed a multifocal lens, but she's clearly skeptical. She's there to get her eyes examined and has no intention of making an expensive purchase. She tells Kildare she doesn't want to try the new lens. Instead of delivering an assertive pitch, Kildare starts asking her questions. What kind of work do you do? He learns that she works at a computer, and he notices that when she's trying to read, she turns her head to privilege her nearsighted eye. When she's looking at something in the distance, as when driving, she turns her head the other way to rely on her farsighted eye. Kildare asks why the doctor has prescribed a new lens, and she mentions that she's struggling with distance, computer work, and reading. He sees that she's getting frustrated and reassures her. If you feel you don't need corrective lenses, I'm not going to waste your time. Let me just ask you one more question. When will you wear these glasses? She says they would really only be useful at work, and they're awfully expensive if she can only wear them part of the day. As he listens to her answer, Kildare realizes that his customer has a misconception about how multifocal lenses can be used. He gently explains that she can use multifocal lenses not only at work, but also in the car and at home. She's intrigued, and she tries them on. A few minutes later, she decides to get fitted for her very first pair of multifocal glasses, spending $725. A taker might have lost the sale. By asking questions, Kildare was able to understand her concerns and address them. But maybe we're stacking the deck in favor of givers. After all, opticians are selling in the healthcare industry where it's easy to believe in the product and care about patients in need. Can givers succeed in sales jobs where customers are more skeptical, like insurance? In one study, managers rated the giving behaviors of more than 1,000 insurance salespeople. Even in insurance, the higher the salesperson's giver score, the greater that salesperson's revenue, policy sold, applications, sales quotas met, and commissions earned. By asking questions and getting to know their customers, givers build trust and gain knowledge about their customers' needs. Over time, this makes them better and better at selling. In one study, pharmaceutical salespeople were assigned to a new product with no existing client base. Each quarter, even though the salespeople were paid commission, the givers pulled further ahead of the others. Moreover, giving was the only characteristic to predict performance. It didn't matter whether the salespeople were conscientious or carefree, extroverted or introverted, emotionally stable or anxious, and open-minded or traditional. The defining quality of a top pharmaceutical salesperson was being a giver. And powerless communication, marked by questions, is the defining quality of how givers sell. Out of curiosity, are you planning to vote in the next presidential election? By asking you that one question, I've just increased the odds that you will actually vote by 41%. That's another benefit of powerless communication. Many people assume that the key to persuasive skill is to deliver a confident, assertive pitch. But in daily life, we're bombarded by advertisers, telemarketers, salespeople, fundraisers, and politicians trying to convince us that we want to buy their products, use their services, and support their causes. When we hear a powerful, persuasive message, we get suspicious. In some cases, we're concerned about being tricked, duped, or manipulated by a taker. In other situations, we just want to make our own free choices rather than having our decisions controlled by someone else. So if I tell you to go out and vote, you might resist. But when I ask if you're planning to vote, you don't feel like I'm trying to influence you. It's an innocent query. And instead of resisting my influence, you reflect on it. Well, I do care about being a good citizen, and I want to support my candidate. This doesn't feel like I'm persuading you. As Aronson explains, you've been convinced by someone you already like and trust, yourself. Dave Walton knows why questions are effective persuasive devices. He sees great lawyers as salespeople, and it's important that they don't sell their arguments too assertively, like takers. The art of advocacy is to lead you to my conclusion on your terms. I want you to form your own conclusions. You'll hold on to them more strongly. I try to walk jurors up that line, drop them off, and let them make up their own minds. Thoughtful questions pave the way for jurors to persuade themselves. According to Aronson, in direct persuasion, the audience is constantly aware of the fact that they have been persuaded by another. Where self-persuasion occurs, people are convinced that the motivation for change has come from within. By asking people questions about their plans and intentions, we increase the likelihood that they actually act on these plans and intentions. Research shows that if I ask you whether you're planning to buy a new computer in the next 6 months, you'll be 18% more likely to go out and get one. But it only works if you already feel good about the intention that the question targets. Studies show that asking questions about your plans to floss your teeth and avoid fatty foods significantly enhances the odds that you will actually floss and eat healthy. These are desirable actions, so questions open the door for you to persuade yourself to engage in them. But if I ask about your plans to do something undesirable, questions don't work. For example, are you planning to eat some chocolate-covered grasshoppers this month? After thinking about it, you're probably even less likely to do it. In the examples that we've covered so far, the givers were selling desirable products to interested customers. When Bill Grumbles was selling HBO, he had customers who were open to a better cable product. When Kildare Escoto and Nancy Phelps sell glasses, they have patients who need new frames or lenses. How do givers change the minds of audiences who aren't so receptive? Persuading, the technique of tentative talk. In 2004, Volkswagen's retail theme was, "Drive it, you'll get it." Consumers connected with the double meaning. The line conveyed that to fully appreciate a Volkswagen's performance features, you had to sit behind the wheel. It also carried another message. If you take the car for a test drive, you'll love it so much that you'll end up buying it. It was just one of a string of memorable campaigns from Arnold Worldwide, Volkswagen's advertising agency. But Don Lane, the man who generated the clever, "Drive it, You'll get it. Theme. Never appeared in the credits. Lane was a senior account executive, not a member of the creative department. His job was to package and sell the creative team's ideas. One day, while stuck on a strategic brief for the creative team, an idea popped into his head. Instead of writing the strategy, he wrote a sample script that ended with the line, "Drive it. You'll get it." It wasn't standard practice for an account person to come to the creative team with a solution instead of a problem to solve. In fact, it was forbidden for an account guy to contribute to the creative process. So Lane had a dilemma. How could he get the creative team to listen? If he were a taker, he might have stormed into the creative director's office to pitch the line, lobby powerfully for it, and demand full credit. If he were a matcher, he might have offered a favor to the creative team and hoped for reciprocity, or called in a favor owed. But Lane leaned in the giver direction. He wasn't concerned about the credit. He just wanted to help the creative team and see a good line get implemented. In our business, creative people are gifted and deserve to get most of, if not all, of the credit. Some account management people resent that. Lane says, "I knew that my job was to help creative people and provide space for them to come up with ideas. I didn't really care if anyone knew it was my idea. It didn't matter where the idea came from. If it worked, we would all share in the success." Lane walked into the creative director's office. Instead of using powerful communication, "I have a great line, you should use it," he went with a softer approach. He presented a sample radio script to show how it would work. Then he said to the creative director, "I know this is against the rules, but I want to give you a sense of what I'm talking about. What do you think of this line? Drive it. You'll get it." The creative director got it. He looked up at Lane, smiled, and said, "That's our campaign." The campaign sold many cars and won several advertising awards. Allison Frigale, a professor at the University of North Carolina, is an expert on the form of powerless communication that Don Lane used effectively. Frigale finds that speech styles send signals about who's a giver and who's a taker. Takers tend to use powerful speech. They're assertive and direct. Givers tend to use more powerless speech, talking with tentative markers like these. Hesitations. "Well, you know." Hedges. "Kinda, sorta, maybe, probably, I think." Disclaimers. "This may be a bad idea, but..." Tag questions. "That's interesting, isn't it?" Or, "That's a good idea, right?" Intensifiers. "Really, very, quite." These markers send a clear message to the audience. The speaker lacks confidence and authority. Lacking confidence is a bad thing, right? If we break down how Don Lane pitched his idea, we can see two markers of powerless speech: a disclaimer and a tag question. His disclaimer was, "I know this is against the rules, but..." And his tag question was, "What do you think?" Frigale shows that when people have to work closely together, such as in teams and service relationships, powerless speech is actually more influential than powerful speech. To illustrate one of her studies, imagine that your plane has just crash-landed in the desert. You're with your coworker, Jamie. You have to prioritize 12 items, including a flashlight and a map, in order of importance for survival. You share your rankings with Jamie, who disagrees. You're not a fan of the flashlight, but Jamie thinks it's critical and decides to deliver a forceful message. "The flashlight needs to be rated higher. It is the only reliable night signaling device. Also, the reflector and lens could be used to start a fire, which is another way to signal for help. Put it higher." Jamie sounds like a taker, and probably is, since takers are inclined to give orders like this. Are you willing to listen to Jamie? If you're like most people, the answer is no. You're supposed to be collaborating, and you don't want to be told what to do, so you resist Jamie's influence. In trying to establish dominance, Jamie has lost prestige. But what if Jamie makes the same suggestion, talking more tentatively, and adding some questions and hedges? Do you think the flashlight should maybe be rated higher? It may be a pretty reliable night signaling device. Also, maybe the reflector and lens could be used to start a fire, which could possibly be another way to signal for help. In Fregale's study, people were much more receptive to this version. Powerless speech signals that Jamie is a giver. By talking tentatively, Jamie shows a willingness to defer to you, or at least take your opinion into consideration. Fregale finds that even when Jamie delivers the exact same message in the exact same tone both times, adding markers of tentative talk such as hedges, tag questions, and intensifiers, earns greater respect and influence. This is why the creative director was so open to Don Lane's idea. Lane signaled that he wasn't trying to threaten the director's authority. It was clear to the creative director that Lane was just trying to share a good idea, and the director knew a good idea when he saw it. Over time, talking tentatively paid off for Lane. He brought ideas up gently and didn't ask for credit. Creative people responded to this approach, and it gave me credibility when I had a creative idea worth sharing, Lane explains. Whereas many of his peers had conflicts with creative people, Lane developed a reputation for being a rare account guy with whom creative people enjoyed working. Instead of seeing him as an outsider stepping on their toes, they saw him as a helpful contributor. They frequently requested him on projects, often saying, "He's helping us. He's not a typical account guy. Let's keep him involved and give him more opportunities." Knowing that he was generous and open, creative teams were willing to share ideas with him and welcome his input rather than guarding their turf more closely. Lane's ability to contribute to creative teams attracted the attention of senior management. At an unusually early stage in his career, Lane was invited to play a key role in the world-renowned Drivers Wanted campaign for Volkswagen. "Givers fear that they'll become invisible," Lane says. "But I've seen givers thrive because people like working with and trust them." Realizing this was a major turbo boost earlier in my career. Lane was promoted more quickly than many of his peers, and he is now an executive vice president and an executive director at Arnold. In the words of one creative vice president, "Don is a complete team player. If I have another opportunity to work with Don, I would jump at the chance." An analysis of tentative talk points to another reason why Dave Walton's stutter might have helped him connect with the jury in the trade secrets trial. Hesitations, hedges, and intensifiers are built-in features of stuttering. When a jury hears Dave Walton stutter, he no longer sounds dominant and imposing. They don't feel that he's trying to convince them, so they lower their resistance. They become just a bit more open to being persuaded by him. When givers use powerless speech, they show us that they have our best interests at heart. But there's one role in which people tend to avoid talking tentatively. Leadership. Not long ago, a marketing manager named Barton Hill found out why. He was leading a business unit at a financial services firm, and he was invited to interview for a major promotion to a higher-level position, where he would lead multiple business units. The interviewer opened with a softball question: "Tell us about your successes." Hill started talking about his team's accomplishments, which were quite impressive. Although Hill was the front-runner for the position, he didn't get it. The interviewer told him he didn't sound like a leader. "I kept using words like we and us," Hill says. "I didn't use enough first-person singular pronouns, like I and me. I found out later that it didn't seem like I was a leader. He thought I didn't drive the team's success and wanted someone who could." The interviewer expected Hill to speak more assertively, and powerless communication cost him the job. By speaking with greater speed, volume, assertiveness, and certainty, takers convince us that they know what they're talking about. In one study conducted by psychologists in California, takers were judged by group members as more competent, but in reality, they weren't more competent. Takers, the study's authors report, attain influence because they behave in ways that make them appear competent, even when they actually lack competence. By failing to use powerful speech in his interview, Barton Hill failed to create the impression of dominance. Yet the same powerless communication that cost him the promotion ended up earning prestige, making his teams successful. Whereas powerful communication might be effective in a one-shot job interview, in a team or a service relationship, it loses the respect and admiration of others. Psychologists in Amsterdam have shown that although group members perceive takers as highly effective leaders, takers actually undermine group performance. Speaking dominantly convinces group members that takers are powerful, but it stifles information sharing, preventing members from communicating good ideas. Teams love it when their leader presents a work product as a collaborative effort. That's what inspires them to contribute. Hill reflects. The paradox comes from people thinking an inclusive leader isn't strong enough to lead a team, when in fact, that leader is stronger, because he engenders the support of the team. People bond to givers, like electromagnetism. Eventually, Hill left for another company, and three of his former employees approached him about joining his team. This type of loyalty has paid off in the long run. Hill's teams have been wildly successful. He is now a managing director and global head of marketing at Citi Transaction Services, a division of more than 20,000 people. Of course, there's a time and place for leaders to use powerful speech. In a study of pizza franchises, colleagues Francesca Gino, Dave Hoffman, and I found that when most employees in a store are dutiful followers, managers are well served to speak powerfully. But when most employees are proactive, generating new ideas for cooking and delivering pizzas more efficiently, powerful speech backfires. When employees were proactive, managers who talked forcefully led their stores to 14% lower profits than managers who talked less assertively and more tentatively. By conveying dominance, the powerful speakers discouraged their proactive employees from contributing. When people use powerful communication, others perceive them as preferring and pursuing individual accomplishments. Frigail writes, at the expense of group accomplishments. Through talking tentatively, the powerless speakers earned prestige. They showed openness to proactive ideas that would benefit the group. To see if this effect would hold up in a more controlled setting, my colleagues and I brought teams of people together to fold T-shirts. We instructed half of the team leaders to talk forcefully and ask the other half to talk more tentatively. Once again, when team members were passive followers, the powerful speakers did just fine. But when team members were highly proactive, taking initiative to come up with a faster way to fold T-shirts, the powerless speakers were much more effective. Proactive teams had 22% higher average output under leaders who spoke powerlessly than powerfully. Team members saw the powerful speakers as threatened by ideas, viewing the powerless speakers as more receptive to suggestions. Talking tentatively didn't establish dominance, but it earned plenty of prestige. Team members worked more productively when the tentative talkers showed that they were open to advice. To a taker, this receptivity to advice may sound like a weakness. By listening to other people's suggestions, givers might end up being unduly influenced by their colleagues. But what if seeking advice is actually a strategy for influencing other people? When givers sit down at the bargaining table, they benefit from advice in unexpected ways. Negotiating. Seeking advice in the shadow of a doubt. In 2007, a Fortune 500 company closed a plant in the Midwest United States. One of the people to lose her position was an effervescent research scientist named Annie. The company offered Annie a transfer to the East Coast, but it would require her to give up on her education. While working full-time, Annie was enrolled in a nighttime MBA program. She couldn't afford to quit her job, and if she did, the company would no longer pay for her degree. Yet if she accepted the transfer, she wouldn't be able to continue studying. She was in a bind, with little time and few options. 2 weeks later, something extraordinary happened. She was offered a seat on the company's private jet, which was normally available only to top executives, with unlimited access until she finished her MBA. She accepted the transfer and spent the next 9 months riding the corporate jet back and forth twice a week until she finished her degree. The company also paid for her rental car every week and commercial plane tickets when the corporate jet wasn't running. How did she get the company to make such a big investment in her? Annie landed all of these perks without ever negotiating. Instead, she used a form of powerless communication that's quite familiar to givers. Entering negotiations, takers typically work to establish a dominant position. Had Annie been a taker, she might have compiled a list of all of her merits and attracted counteroffers from rival companies to strengthen her position. Matchers are more inclined to see negotiating as an opportunity for quid pro quo. If Annie were a matcher, she would have gone to a senior leader who owed her a favor and asked for reciprocity. But Annie is a giver. She mentors dozens of colleagues, volunteers for the United Way, and visits elementary school classes to interest students in science. When her colleagues make a mistake, she's regularly the one to take responsibility, shielding them from the blame at the expense of her own performance. She once withdrew a job application when she learned that a friend was applying for the same position. As a giver, Annie wasn't comfortable bargaining like a taker or a matcher. So she chose an entirely different strategy. She reached out to a human resources manager and asked for advice. "If you were in my shoes, what would you do?" The manager became Annie's advocate. She reached out to the heads of Annie's department and site and started to lobby on Annie's behalf. The department head, in turn, called Annie and asked what he could do to keep her. Annie mentioned that she wanted to finish her MBA, but couldn't afford to fly back and forth. In response, the department head offered her a seat on the jet. New research shows that advice seeking is a surprisingly effective strategy for exercising influence when we lack authority. In one experiment, researcher Katie Lilienquist had people negotiate the possible sale of commercial property. When the sellers focused on their goal of getting the highest possible price, only 8% reached a successful agreement. When the sellers asked the buyers for advice on how to meet their goals, 42% reached a successful agreement. Asking for advice encouraged greater cooperation and information sharing, turning a potentially contentious negotiation into a win-win deal. Studies demonstrate that across the manufacturing, financial services, insurance, and pharmaceuticals industries, seeking advice is among the most effective ways to influence peers, superiors, and subordinates. Advice seeking tends to be significantly more persuasive than the taker's preferred tactics of pressuring subordinates and ingratiating superiors. Advice seeking is also consistently more influential than the matcher's default approach of trading favors. This is true even in the upper echelons of major corporations. Recently, strategy professors Itai Stern and James Westfall studied executives at 350 large U.S. industrial and service firms, hoping to find out how executives land seats on boards of directors. Board seats are coveted by executives as they often pay six-figure salaries, send clear status signals, and enrich networks by granting access to the corporate elite. Takers assume that the best path to a board seat is ingratiation. They flatter a director with compliments, or track down his friends to praise him indirectly. Yet Stern and Westfall found that flattery only worked when it was coupled with advice-seeking. Instead of just complimenting a director, executives who got board seats were more likely to seek advice along with the compliment. When praising a director's skill, the advice-seeking executives asked how she mastered it. When extolling a director's success in a task, these executives asked for recommendations about how to replicate his success. When executives asked a director for advice in this manner, that director was significantly more likely to recommend them for a board appointment, and they landed more board seats as a result. Advice-seeking is a form of powerless communication that combines expressing vulnerability, asking questions, and talking tentatively. When we ask others for advice, we're posing a question that conveys uncertainty and makes us vulnerable. Instead of confidently projecting that we have all the answers, we're admitting that others might have superior knowledge. As a result, takers and matchers tend to shy away from advice-seeking. From a taker's perspective, asking for advice means acknowledging that you don't have all the answers. Takers may fear that seeking advice might make them look weak, dependent, or incompetent. They're wrong. Research shows that people who regularly seek advice and help from knowledgeable colleagues are actually rated more favorably by supervisors than those who never seek advice or help. Appearing vulnerable doesn't bother givers, who worry far less about protecting their egos and projecting certainty. When givers ask for advice, it's because they're genuinely interested in learning from others. Matchers hold back on advice-seeking for a different reason. They might owe something in return. According to Lilienquist, advice-seeking has four benefits: learning, perspective-taking, commitment, and flattery. When Annie asked for advice, she discovered something she didn't know before. The company's jet had extra seats, and it traveled back and forth between her two key locations. Had she lobbied more assertively instead of seeking advice, she might never have gained this information. In fact, Annie had several previous conversations in which no one mentioned the jet. This brings us to the second benefit of advice-seeking: encouraging others to take our perspectives. In Annie's previous conversations, where she didn't ask for advice, the department head focused on the company's interest in transferring her while saving as much money as possible. The advice request changed the conversation. When we ask for advice, in order to give us a recommendation, advisors have to look at the problem or dilemma from our point of view. It was only when Annie sought guidance that the department head ended up considering the problem from her perspective, at which point the corporate jet dawned on him as a solution. Once the department head proposed this solution, the third benefit of advice-seeking kicked in: commitment. The department head played a key role in generating the jet solution. Since it was his idea, and he had already invested some time and energy in trying to help Annie, he was highly motivated to help her further. He ended up paying for the rental car that she used in the Midwest and agreeing to fund commercial flights if the corporate jet was not running. There's no doubt that Annie earned these privileges through a combination of hard work, talent, and generosity. But a clever study sheds further light on why the department head was so motivated to offer Annie more than just the corporate jet. Half a century ago, the psychologists John Jecker and David Landy paid people for succeeding on a geometry task. In the control group, the participants kept the money and visited the department secretary to fill out a final questionnaire. But when another group of participants started to leave, the researcher asked them for help. "I was wondering if you would do me a favor. The funds for this experiment have run out, and I'm using my own money to finish the experiment. As a favor to me, would you mind returning the money you won?" Nearly all of the participants gave the money back. when questioned about how much they liked the researcher, the people who had done him the favor liked him substantially more than the people who didn't. Why? When we give our time, energy, knowledge, or resources to help others, we strive to maintain a belief that they're worthy and deserving of our help. Seeking advice is a subtle way to invite someone to make a commitment to us. Once the department head took the time to offer advice to Annie, he became more invested in her. Helping Annie generate a solution reinforced his commitment to her. She must be worthy of his time. If she wasn't important to him, why would he have bothered to help her? As Benjamin Franklin wrote in his autobiography, "He that has once done you a kindness will be more ready to do you another than he whom you yourself have obliged." When we ask people for advice, we grant them prestige, showing that we respect and admire their insights and expertise. Since most people are matchers, they tend to respond favorably and feel motivated to support us in return. When Annie approached the human resources manager for advice, the manager stepped up and went to bat for her. According to biographer Walter Isaacson, Benjamin Franklin saw advice-seeking as a form of flattery. Franklin had a fundamental rule for winning friends, Isaacson writes. Appeal to their pride and vanity by constantly seeking their opinion and advice, and they will admire you for your judgment and wisdom. Regardless of their reciprocity styles, people love to be asked for advice. Giving advice makes takers feel important, and it makes givers feel helpful. Matchers often enjoy giving advice for a different reason. It's a low-cost way of racking up credits that they can cash in later. As a result, when we ask people for advice, they tend to respond positively to us. But here's the catch. Advice-seeking only works if it's genuine. In her research on advice-seeking, Lillian Quist finds that success depends on the target perceiving it as a sincere and authentic gesture. When she directly encouraged people to seek advice as an influence strategy, it fell flat. Their counterparts recognized them as fakers. They could tell that the advice seekers were ingratiating based on ulterior motives. People who are suspected of strategically managing impressions are more likely to be seen as selfish, cold, manipulative, and untrustworthy, Lillian Quist writes. Advice seeking was only effective when people did it spontaneously. Since givers are more willing to seek advice than takers and matchers, it's likely that many of the spontaneous advice seekers in her studies were givers. They were actually interested in other people's perspectives and recommendations, and they were rated as better listeners. I believe this applies more generally to powerless communication. It works for givers because they establish a sincere intent to act in the best interest of others. When presenting, givers make it clear that they're expressing vulnerability, not only to earn prestige, but also to make a genuine connection with the audience. When selling, givers ask questions in a way that conveys the desire to help customers, not take advantage of them. When persuading and negotiating, givers speak tentatively and seek advice because they truly value the ideas and viewpoints of others. Powerless communication is the natural language of many givers, and one of the great engines behind their success. Expressing vulnerability, asking questions, talking tentatively, and seeking advice can open doors to gaining influence, but the way we direct that influence will reverberate throughout our work lives, including some we've already discussed, like building networks and collaborating with colleagues. As you'll hear later, not every giver uses powerless communication, but those who do often find that it's useful in situations where we need to build rapport and trust. It can't easily be faked, but if you fake it long enough, it might become more real than you expected. And as Dave Walton discovered, powerless communication can be far more powerful and effective than meets the ear. Chapter 6. The Art of Motivation Maintenance. Why some givers burn out, but others are on fire. The intelligent altruists, though less altruistic than the unintelligent altruists, will be fitter than both unintelligent altruists and selfish individuals. Herbert Simon, Nobel Prize winner in economics. Up to this point, we've been focusing on how givers climb to the top of the success ladder through the unique ways that they build networks, collaborate, communicate, influence, and help others achieve their potential. But as you heard in the opening chapter, givers are also more likely to end up at the bottom of the success ladder. Success involves more than just capitalizing on the strengths of giving. It also requires avoiding the pitfalls. If people give too much time, they end up making sacrifices for their collaborators and network ties at the expense of their own energy. If people give away too much credit and engage in too much powerless communication, it's all too easy for them to become pushovers and doormats, failing to advance their own interests. The consequence: givers end up exhausted and unproductive. Since the strategies that catapult givers to the top are distinct from those that sink givers to the bottom, it's critical to understand what differentiates successful givers from failed givers. The next three chapters examine why some givers burn out while others are on fire, how givers avoid being exploited by takers, and what individuals, groups, and organizations can do to protect givers and spread their success. Recently, the Canadian psychologists Jeremy Frimer and Larry Walker led an ambitious effort to figure out what motivates highly successful givers. The participants were winners of the Caring Canadian Award, the country's highest honor for giving, recognizing people who have devoted many years of their lives to help their communities or advance a humanitarian cause. Many winners of this award have sustained extraordinary giving efforts for decades in order to make a difference. To reveal what drove them, all of the participants filled out a questionnaire, asking them to list 10 goals in response to, "I typically try to..." Then, Walker conducted in-depth interviews with 25 Caring Canadian winners and a comparison group of 25 people who matched the winners in gender, age, ethnicity, and education, but had not sustained the same level or duration of giving. Walker spent 100 hours interviewing all 50 people about their lives, covering key periods and critical events in childhood, adolescence, and adulthood. From there, independent raters read the goal lists, listened to the interview tapes, and rated the degree to which the participants expressed two key motivations: self-interest and other interest. Self-interest involved pursuing power and achievement, whereas other interest focused on being generous and helpful. On which set of motivations did the Caring Canadian winners score higher than the comparison group? The intuitive answer is other interest, and it's correct. In their life stories, the Caring Canadians mentioned giving and helping more than three times as often as the comparison group. When they listed their goals, the Caring Canadians listed nearly twice as many goals related to other interest as the comparison group. The Caring Canadians highlighted goals like serve as a positive role model to young people and advocate for women from a low-income bracket. The comparison participants were more likely to mention goals like get my golf handicap to a single digit, be attractive to others, and hunt the biggest deer and catch big fish. But here's the surprise. The Caring Canadians also scored higher on self-interest. In their life stories, these highly successful givers mentioned a quest for power and achievement almost twice as often as the comparison group. In their goals, the Caring Canadians had roughly 20% more objectives related to gaining influence, earning recognition, and attaining individual excellence. The successful givers weren't just more other-oriented than their peers. They were also more self-interested. Successful givers, it turns out, are just as ambitious as takers and matchers. These results have fascinating implications for our understanding of why some givers succeed, but others fail. Up until this point, we've looked at reciprocity styles on a continuum from taking to giving. Is your primary concern for your own interests or others' interests? Now I want to complicate that understanding by looking at the interplay of self-interest and other interest. Takers score high in self-interest and low in other interest. They aim to maximize their own success without much concern for other people. By contrast, givers always score high on other interest, but they vary in self-interest. There are two types of givers, and they have dramatically different success rates. Selfless givers are people with high other interest and low self-interest. They give their time and energy without regard for their own needs, and they pay a price for it. Selfless giving is a form of pathological altruism, which is defined by researcher Barbara Oakley as an unhealthy focus on others to the detriment of one's own needs, such that, in the process of trying to help others, givers end up harming themselves. In one study, college students who scored high on selfless giving declined in grades over the course of the semester. These selfless givers admitted missing class and failing to study because they were attending to friends' problems. Most people assume that self-interest and other interest are opposite ends of one continuum. Yet in my studies of what drives people at work, I've consistently found that self-interest and other interest are completely independent motivations. You can have both of them at the same time. As Bill Gates argued at the World Economic Forum, there are two great forces of human nature, self-interest and caring for others. And people are most successful when they are driven by a hybrid engine of the two. If takers are selfish and failed givers are selfless, successful givers are otherish. They care about benefiting others, but they also have ambitious goals for advancing their own interests. Selfless giving, in the absence of self-preservation instincts, easily becomes overwhelming. Being otherish means being willing to give more than you receive, but still keeping your own interests in sight, using them as a guide for choosing when, where, how, and to whom you give. Instead of seeing self-interest and other interest as competing, the caring Canadians found ways to integrate them so they could do well by doing good. As you'll hear, when concern for others is coupled with a healthy dose of concern for the self, givers are less prone to burning out and getting burned, and they're better positioned to flourish. In West Philadelphia, born and raised, on the playground is where I spent most of my days. I got in one little fight, and my mom got scared. When Will Smith wrote these famous lyrics for the theme song of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, the hit sitcom that launched his career, he had just graduated from Overbrook High School in Philadelphia. Overbrook has a majestic facade, its five-story building resembling a castle perched atop a hill. During his time in the castle, Smith was treated like royalty, earning the nickname Prince from teachers for his ability to charm his way out of trouble. Years later, when he started a production company, he named it Overbrook Entertainment. Smith is not the only accomplished person to attend Overbrook, whose alumni include astronaut Guion Bluford Jr., the first African-American in space, and John Drummond, an Olympic gold medalist in track. Overbrook is one of just six high schools in the entire United States that has seen more than 10 students go on to play in the National Basketball Association, one of whom was the legendary Wilt Chamberlain. But for most students, Overbrook is no fairy tale. Located at the corner of 59th and Lancaster, in the heart of West Philadelphia, Overbrook is just a few blocks from one of the top 10 drug corners in the country. Take a stroll past the school, and it's not uncommon to see the drivers of passing cars rolling up their windows and locking their doors. In 2006, Overbrook was one of 28 schools in the United States that was identified as persistently dangerous, based on crime statistics. As of 2011, there were roughly 1,200 students enrolled at Overbrook, and nearly 500 were suspended at some point during the school year, racking up nearly 50 assaults and 20 weapons or drugs charges. The educational prospects for students are similarly dismal. On the SAT, Overbrook's average hovers more than 300 points below the national average, with more than three-quarters of students in the bottom 25% of the country. Nearly half of all students who start high school at Overbrook will never finish. The graduation rate is just 54%. In the hopes of turning this tragic situation around, a core of talented, passionate young educators has arrived at Overbrook from Teach for America, TFA, the renowned nonprofit organization that sends college graduates to spend 2 years fighting educational inequity as teachers in some of the most disadvantaged schools in the country. TFA is filled with givers. Research shows that the vast majority of teachers join to make a difference in students' lives. Many come from privileged backgrounds, and they're determined to help students who are less fortunate. As one anonymous teacher put it, "I knew throughout my life that I wanted to do something where I help. Social justice issues burn within me, and the fact that so many students have been so viciously failed by the school systems in this country is infuriating and invigorating. I want every child to grow up, to be able to make choices. Education can be an equalizer. It's a justice issue, and by joining TFA, I saw a way to help make it my issue, too." In the past 20 years, more than 20,000 teachers have worked for TFA, making tremendous strides toward promoting educational equity. But sheltered lives in suburbs and sororities leave many teachers dramatically unprepared for the trials and tribulations of inner-city schools. In the Overbrook hallways, the school's massive difficulties fell hard on the shoulders of a 24-year-old TFA neophyte named Conray Callahan. With white skin and blonde hair, Conray stood out in the halls like a sore thumb. 97% of Overbrook students are African American. Conray, a dog lover who lives with Louie, the mutt she rescued, grew up in a cozy Maryland suburb, attending a high school that was named one of the best in the country. Calling her a ball of energy would be an understatement. She runs half marathons, captained her high school soccer and lacrosse teams, and competed for 6 years in jump rope competitions, making the Junior Olympics. Although her intellectual prowess led her Vanderbilt professors to encourage her to pursue history, Conray set her sights on more practical matters. "I set out to make a difference, improving education and opportunities for kids in low-income communities." But Conray's idealistic dreams of inspiring the next generation of students were quickly crushed by the harsh realities of arriving at school at 6:45 a.m., staying up until 1 a.m. to finish grading and lesson plans for her Spanish classes, and days marked by breaking up fights, battling crime, and trying to track down truant students who only showed up for 2 days of class in an entire year. One of Conray's most promising students was living in a foster home and had to drop out of school after giving birth to a child with developmental problems. Conray was constantly complaining to one of her closest friends, an investment banker who worked 100 hours a week and couldn't grasp why teaching at Overbrook was so stressful. In an act of desperation, Conray invited the friend to join her on a school field trip. The friend finally understood. She couldn't believe the sheer exhaustion that she felt at the end of the day, Conray recalls. Finally, Conray hit rock bottom. "It was awful. I was burned out, overwhelmed, and ready to give up," I never wanted to set foot in a school again. I was disgusted with the school, the students, and myself. Conray was displaying the classic symptoms of burnout,